Stay tuned now on 1460 WVOX for The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin. The Ballot Box is a monthly program brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Now, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Good morning and welcome to The Ballot Box. I'm Tamar Tate and I'm joined on this beautiful February morning, which feels more like April, by my co-host Nina Lubin. And we're coming to you on behalf of the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle, courtesy of WVOX 1460 AM and our talented sound engineer, Gerald Bell. How are you, Nina? How was vacation?
Vacation was lovely, thank you. And good to return to spring weather. I have a small outside garden that I know is trying day by day to figure out what to do. Are we going to grow? Are we not going to grow? Also, I guess it's kind of a little signal for us to figure out what we're going to do, too, with this weather. How about you?
You know, back in August, I did this Costco run, and my kid was going off to college, so I had to hit Costco, and I saw they had all these bags of salt, and I said to myself, I am so ahead of this game. I packed the cart with all these bags that I could barely lift, and now they've just been sitting in my garage, so feeling not so good about having
next
done
to the
that purchase.
Snow boots and the Arctic wear.
Who knows? We still could get a surprise. But anyway, we've got a great show.
Yes.
Nina, why don't you introduce our guest? I'm very excited. Another fellow New Rochellian.
Very happy to, Tamar. Steve Silverman is president and CEO of Endurance Strategic Communications, LLC. He was the chief speechwriter for Governor Andrew Cuomo, and he was a senior White House advisor to President Bill Clinton. He's written for corporate executives, political leaders, and philanthropists, including former New York City Mayor Mike Bloomberg, and A.J. Banga, the current vice chairman of the board at the growth equity firm General Atlantic. Tamar and I both read Steve's January 9th commentary in U.S. News and World Report entitled, "The Fight for American Democracy is Here." We were struck by its distinctly nonpartisan tone, and frankly, we appreciated it in these days of political divisiveness. We asked Steve to join us on the Ballot Box for a deeper dive. So, Steve, thank you for finding the time to join us this morning, and welcome to the Ballot Box.
Thank you very much, Nina and Tamar. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate the invitation. Glad to have this conversation.
Great, great. So, diving in, you opened your U.S. News and World Report opinion piece, which was published on the anniversary of the January 6, 2021 insurrection, with a quote, and I quote, "Wherever you stand on the political spectrum, the day is full of meaning." The January 6th insurrection day, full of meaning. Can you explain why and how?
It was a day that our nation clearly had a moment of incredible anxiety, a moment where some portion of the nation, a number of people felt it was necessary to take over and stop the democratic process, and getting in the way of what is a normally smooth transition of power. But the reason I framed it in terms of different perspectives, I may have my own views on that, as do most Americans have views, but I have felt in my writing over the years that if I take a strong view at the very beginning of a piece, people may stop reading. And so I wanted to make it more about the future and what we can learn from that day, January 6th, 2021. And then that's why I brought up President Roosevelt's January 6th speech in 1941. So it was an awful day for the country on January 6th, but, you know, there are still certainly different perspectives on it. In this piece, it wasn't for me to offer the view on ultimately you know, what should happen.
Steve, it's Tamar. First, thanks again so much for joining us on the Ballot Box. We're so happy to have this conversation. We loved your piece, and what I found most interesting was you talked in depth about President Roosevelt's January 6th speech in 1941, the Four Freedoms speech, which after I read your article, I actually listened to in full to a recording online of that. Can you remind our listeners of the content and context of that speech and why, as you asserted in your commentary, it's a speech that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky could be citing today?
Well, absolutely. It's a good question, Tamar. About a year ago, I was doing some research for Mike Bloomberg, and I was doing some work for him at the time. And I just stumbled upon this incredible fact that I hadn't seen written about. I'm not saying it hadn't been written about, but I hadn't seen it, that there was this remarkable connection between January 6th, 2021, and this remarkable speech in American history on January 6th, 1941. And it was a moment where the United States was still feeling deeply isolationist. There had been obviously the World War and the crash in 1929, depression, and a lot of Americans were really not interested in what was happening in other parts of the world. And this was a moment where Roosevelt stood before the Congress and declared in very, very clear terms that what was happening in Europe was vital to what was happening in the United States. And just because it's a few thousand miles away does not mean that we do not need to be concerned.
Just to clarify, just for our listeners, this was before we were actually in the war. Pearl Harbor hadn't been bombed yet.
Correct. This was January 1941. Pearl Harbor didn't come until December 1941. And then we didn't enter into the war until 1942. So this was still a stage where there was a lot of debate in this country. Actually, there was also a lot of there was a good amount of pushback, again, as about isolationism. But also, there was a Nazi movement in this country. In fact, we're talking now, I'm in the east side of Manhattan, and the Nazi headquarters, the Bund, was five blocks away from here. And so I always think about the relevance of the history that we're living in now and thinking back to the history of then. And while things change quite a lot, fortunately, you can look back at history and see some real similarities. And so Roosevelt was pushing back against, I would say, apathy, but also some folks who really were very empathetic to the Nazi cause.
So when you say it's something that President Zelensky could be citing, what do you think he would, how do you think he would frame something like this?
Absolutely. Roosevelt spoke about the Four Freedoms, and it's essentially a plea for the importance of democracy. Why do we need to be focused on Europe? Why do we need to send arms potentially to Europe in the Second World War? And, you know, the Four Freedoms, which we can discuss in a minute, but, you know, this is a moment where Zelensky is desperate for support from the United States, from Britain, from France, from other allies. He's not necessarily saying, I need people, I don't need soldiers, but I do need your military might. And this was something Roosevelt was very, very focused on. In fact, you know, in a talk a few weeks before this important address, he had talked about the arsenal of democracy, that we're going to be there for you, Europe. We're going to be able to send you military equipment, ships, munitions, and the like, and making very clear that if we don't do that, the war could very easily come to our shores. And I think Zelensky's made that that very case.
Okay, Steve, excuse me, we are headed toward a break. When we come back, we can I'll let you finish your thought, and also we'd like to take a quick summary of FDR's Four Freedoms, if you could provide us that.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. Our guest this morning is Steve Silverman, who has worked as chief speechwriter for Andrew Cuomo and was a senior White House advisor to President Bill Clinton. And before the break, we were talking about Steve's recent commentary piece in U.S. News and World Report, which discussed the January 6th insurrection and drew sort of a dotted line between that and another January 6th in 1941 when President Franklin Roosevelt gave his famous Four Freedoms speech. So the Four Freedoms, Steve is going to tell us what those were in the 1941 address. And Steve, when you go into that, I have a couple of questions about where that actually led on a domestic level. So why don't you bring us on back and let's talk about the Four Freedoms.
Absolutely. So we've talked about the context, and now, you know, this is where towards the very end of the speech, really, Roosevelt gets into the meat and potatoes of what would become exceptionally important for framing American policy going forward. So the first is the freedom of speech and expression, which is enshrined, of course, in the Bill of Rights. But he adds everywhere in the world. So we're thinking more broadly about the United States. The second is the freedom of every person to worship God in his own way, again, enshrined in the Bill of Rights. But he, again, adds everywhere in the world. He was thinking big. The third is freedom from want, which, you know, he explains means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants. Again, everywhere in the world. That is broader, of course, than in the Bill of Rights, and that's a notion that is not everybody in the world abides by or focuses on, but it's something that Roosevelt very much was focused on. And then the fourth is freedom from fear, which in his view was a worldwide reduction in armaments in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against a neighbor anywhere in the world. And so those then, and you ask a great question, Tamar, those became not only the rallying cry for America over the next few years, and he did it in advance of when he, he was aware that things were dicey, right? So a few months later, we did the Lend-Lease arrangement with Great Britain, where we began to ship the munitions and ships, and then they would ultimately return or pay us back for, but he knew that was coming. And then, of course, later that year, as we mentioned earlier, was Pearl Harbor. So what was brilliant about this, he framed the next 4 years, at least, in strong values that Americans at the time mostly could get behind. And so when we were taking all these policy decisions, people were getting revved up to participate. And one of the big ones, you ask about domestic policy, during this speech, he was calling on the corporate sector, they were calling on labor, everybody to get together. And he actually, it was very interesting, and I was just listening to it this morning. He said, you know, this is not, we're in good shape, but not great shape. We've got to really pick up what we're doing. We've got enough airplanes, but we need more, we need our ships to keep up and build more quickly. And so he was really lighting the fire under the American people and is extremely, you know, well known, it was a moment in time where, for the most part, Americans banded together, worked 24 hours, factories were open all night. People really came together to create what was first munitions and armaments for our allies, and then, you know, just 1 year or so later became armaments that our troops used when we entered the war. So it was really, this moment really set up a lot for the future.
So these four freedoms that he articulated, they were really both social and economic-based freedoms. And what I think on the domestic front is interesting about them, and perhaps he engineered it this way on purpose, it formed the platform of his New Deal program, which I think most historians today would agree brought a large increase in the power of the federal government. Steve, isn't large federal government actually one of the main complaints that many modern-day Republicans, and yeah, I guess incidentally many of the January 6th insurrectionists have, right, a federal government that's unwieldy and overreaching? And then this begs the question of how great a role the government should actually play in protecting our freedoms. Can you comment on that?
Sure. And there's no doubt that, you know, Roosevelt took these actions in the 30s, New Deal, creating, you know, parks and creating bridges and expanding the size of the government, as you say, in a time of economic peril. And over the years after that, one of the great debates our country has had, and you see it most pronounced, say, with President Reagan, one of the truly great communicators. But, you know, it was a moment of sort of, wait, we've got to push back on this. You know, states' rights, we don't need the federal government involved in every parts of our lives. And so you're absolutely right. This was a moment where things were expanding rapidly. I mean, there's parallels in my mind of, you know, some of the decisions that President Biden took coming out of or in the middle of COVID when he took office. He, you know, passed legislation that, you know, dramatically increased the amount of money that was going out to people who were impacted by COVID. He spent, you know, a tremendous amount of money on infrastructure and climate change. But, you know, there are people who push back saying that's, you know, way too much. You know, I don't want to necessarily get into, you know, which is right, which is wrong. That's a great debate. But at least it's a substantive debate, which mm-hmm. I think these days we don't get to have those substantive discussions, which is one of the reasons your program is so important. It's a conversation about these issues. But it gives the American people a chance to sort of understand, do they want, whether it's Social Security or Medicare or whatnot, what are the substantive issues that we most care about? And a lot of those conversations were started by President Roosevelt during this era of the 1940s and late 30s.
Okay, thanks, Steve. We're going to take another break. Yes, this is the discussion we hope to have in Congress. Okay, we'll be back after the break.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Hi, and welcome back to The Ballot Box. We are here with our guest, Steve Silverman, the CEO of Endurance Strategic Communications, LLC. Steve, thank you so much for your input so far this morning and your background knowledge. We've talked about international, moving into more domestic And now I want to plunge a little further into domestic, speaking about domestic communications. And we're delighted that, among other things, you are a professional communicator. So here goes a question. In the 1941 FDR speech, FDR did not have the benefit of social media to help relay his message. So, given the widespread use of social media today as an effective political tool, can you share your thoughts on social media's effect on democracy? On one hand, it's the very embodiment of free speech. But on the other hand, it can be used and misused to undermine our democratic principles, sow distrust in the government, encourage seditious behavior, and all that other bad stuff we have seen and heard about. What are your thoughts on the role of social media in our democracy?
Well, you're absolutely right. In Roosevelt, the State of the Union wasn't televised, actually, until I think it was Truman's first State of the Union a number of years later. So you're absolutely right, Nina. It would be interesting to hear what Roosevelt had to say about social media,
yes.
If you could ever imagine. It's interesting. You're right on. There's incredible upside. You look at, the spring in Egypt a number of years ago, which was, freedom and freedom movements and the Arab Spring. And, people wouldn't have known about that, and it wouldn't have spread as rapidly without social media. And the sharing of ideas and information and a lot of the really positive movements of the last number of years. You look at after George Floyd and the fact that there was video and that spread like wildfire. You look at what happened, the tragedy in Memphis. Just a few weeks ago, with the killing of after a traffic stop, And so there's an incredibly positive side to social media. The downside is absolutely there's a tremendous amount of information that is spread that is inaccurate, and now you can have deep fakes where the videos look actually real. I think that hurt particularly during COVID. There was a lot of kind of bad information out there, and it's very hard to defeat the bad information with the good information. It's just the nature of it. Negative usually works more effectively. If you look at politics, negative advertising is no one really wants to do it, but it is extremely effective. I think one of the biggest challenges with social media now is that you really can go into your own world, into your own camp. And there's, you can go into your own narrative, if you will.
Your echo chamber.
Say again.
Your echo chamber.
Absolutely. And so you don't, and it goes back and forth with television. Certain people want to listen to Fox News, and that's up to them. And then they might go back into their online echo chamber. Certain people want to watch MSNBC, and they go back into their echo chamber. And I find it myself sometimes if watching television, if the narrative isn't what I'm expecting, I'm like, well, what, what's that all about? And lately I've been starting to watch PBS because I feel like it's kind of newsy and straight down the middle to the extent that's possible. But I think in the last few years, things have gotten, kind of way worse. COVID, certainly did not help. People are really alone in their homes or apartments. And, you could really go down rabbit holes, and you see that. A lot of the people who did participate in the insurrection on January 6th, there was a huge element of, there weren't people, pushing back or saying, wait a second, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And I think it's deeply troubling. I don't, no one yet has a grand solution. Mm-hmm. I know people are trying to think about it, but, and it's hard. And, I know there's a lot of talk about whether the social media companies have a role to play, and maybe they do, and we'll leave that to Congress to figure out. But the fact that nowadays it's very hard to have conversations with people who you might not agree with, again, that's why this is so important, and the fact that social media is everywhere, and it is. So I guess what I'm saying is maybe there's more negative side to positive side. Mm-hmm. So I still think I check every once in a while on Twitter because, for example, you get up to date sort of information. And you got to make sure it's reliable. And I think classes that are being taught on how to make sure information is accurate is really important. And that's a huge obligation, I think, for schools and parents. But if we're not careful, this could continue to take us down a very negative path. And as Roosevelt was saying, you know, there are moments where we all have to come together to defend our nation. And, you know, I thought when the Ukraine war broke out, this was a moment where Americans were going to come together. And to a large extent, we have. But, there's still, people who push back and say, this or that. And it hasn't affected the overall discussion, the overall conversation we're having as Americans. I thought when you saw people fighting back for democracy, putting their lives, many lives on the line, and the awful impact it's had on the Ukrainian people and the extraordinary leadership and extraordinary courage of all its people, I kind of thought that would lead to a different kind of debate and discussion in this country, because they're showing what it means to come up against autocracy, and they're fighting back. And yet in this country, you still have, people who maybe don't fully understand what it means to be live in an autocratic society. I'm pretty confident it's not something most people would want to live in.
Hmm. Steve, I see a rough parallel between, we were talking about big government, little government, and how you deal with this is you just keep talking and making the changes and compromises you need to make to move the country forward, and the social media, the fact that we are in our own echo chambers, we are not reaching across calmly. I'm not even approaching fighting yet, but just the discussions that need to happen and the compromises that need to be made. I remember American history, there were a million compromises made throughout American history, the compromise of 18 this and 17 that, to move forward, that vital need for discussions like I think we used to have with family and friends.
Yeah, I think social media actually has a chilling effect on that to some extent.
Because of the echo chambers.
Yes, exactly, because the social media seems to frame our context for how we view what's going on in society. In my son's class on communications, the professor told the students to specifically listen to or follow social media on both sides of the political spectrum. And the upshot for a lot of these students, which was shocking for them, was how the same event that is occurring, any news event is just completely different depending on who you're following in terms of the reporting.
A good example is, I think, most of the networks were covering, the January 6th hearings pretty intensely, and I think some networks just chose not to cover it at all, which makes it harder then to get some of these basic facts out. I'm old enough to remember television is the evening news at 6:30 with sort of Tom Brokaw and Walter Cronkite and whatnot. And so at least during those, this is not only 30 or so, 40 years ago, people had a common, a sense of facts. Now you can argue whether there's perspective, and perhaps so, because nothing is completely objective. But it was at least there was a moment where, people kind of had a sense of this is what happened in the world today. And nowadays, you don't have that.
Right.
And so people, I love that quote, and I now can't remember who it is, but, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not to your own facts. And that, I always think about that. And sometimes I wonder, it's what, people can see, they can, it's like know what you see, not see what you know, which is just to me is remain curious, ask questions. And so a good example of that is, not too long ago, there was legislation passed to invest in an infrastructure. And maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to pick that up right after the break.
Let's return now to The Ballot Box with your hosts, Tamar Tate and Nita Lubin, brought to you by the League of Women Voters of New Rochelle. Once again, The Ballot Box on 1460 WVOX.
Welcome back. Our guest is Steve Silverman, who is the CEO of Endurance Strategic Communications, LLC. And Steve, you have such an interesting professional background. You've worked on both sides of the aisle with Democrats and Republicans both. Before we get into that, and I really do want to hear a bit more about it, I don't want to let the hour slip away without touching on another article you wrote in addition to the Four Freedoms article. You wrote it just before President Biden's recent State of the Union address. And you were reminiscing about the excitement behind the scenes when President Clinton gave his addresses. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit, I'm curious, about what goes on behind the scenes at that kind of an event, and maybe tell us about some of the changes you've seen since then, since President Clinton in the 1990s and now, and how important is the State of the Union address today?
Thanks, Tamar. That's a good question. To me, those were very exciting moments because it's the one moment each year where, you know, the president takes the floor and explains to the country, as Roosevelt did, what the core focus is of the coming year, with some reminders of success in the last year or so. It is, you know, fascinating to me. What happens during the chamber? I think in the 90s, there was, even though there was a strong push by Newt Gingrich and folks, there was still a lot of comedy, C-O-M-I-T-Y, where there was still respect for the presidency. I think in the last few years now, we see that there is more disrespect, there's more acting out, there's more shouting. You know, there's a little more drama. You heard it this year. I think you heard it, you know, 5-6 years ago with President Obama. Nancy Pelosi, I'm a great fan of, but she tore up the Trump State of the Union. So there's a little bit more drama, maybe a mind for what's happening on the television cameras, I suppose. But I used to love going up there early to the House chamber, the very same chamber where Roosevelt delivered his remarks in 41, the very same chamber that was taken over on January 6th, 2021. And the cabinet's role that night is to be there to support the president. And so we would go in early to make sure with the protocol folks of the House staff that they were seated exactly where they needed to be seated, that the right order was being followed. That there was, you know, because there's other, you know, factors that are going on. You have the Supreme Court justices, you have the military. So I always enjoyed that. And in the moments, you know, before, this is when C-SPAN would cover, and it was the one time a year where I think I was actually on camera a little bit, so my friends and family could actually see that I wasn't making it up, that I worked in the White House. But I did enjoy, it's like a bit of a Super Bowl for political geeks, because you have, you know, all the, you know, the senators and the members of the House there. I always also found it interesting and enjoyable that typically members of the House would get there very early, those who wanted to be on the aisle, to get their moment with the president, whoever that might be. And it was always, that was even for, it's fun to see even for congresspeople, and some senators, like that's still an exciting moment. And frankly, you saw it this year, and there was a controversial moment where, Congressman Santos, got himself to the edge, and he sounds like, or looks like he wanted to meet the president. And, Senator Romney kind of spoke to him and said, you know, to the extent of, you know, you don't belong here. But it's something that people do relish, the chance to have that moment with the president. And I would, once he came in the room, I would then scurry to the corners. You know, I would find myself a good standing place. There was definitely no seat for Steve Silverman. It was more, I was a staff guy through and through, but it was always fun. And as I wrote, I always enjoyed afterwards, taking my time getting out, because it does, it is, you're participating in history, and you're in a building that's historic. And to see it come to life, and you see what's happening, and why it matters, why our capital is the image around the world of freedom. And that's why when January 6th, 2021 happened, so many of us were, so aghast and sad and concerned. And what did this mean? And what did this, tell the rest of the world? If this can happen here in this country,
right.
How does that bode for the rest of the world? Now, how does it change? The other thing I think changed, I noticed this year, it used to be that the cabinet would sit sort of to the left, to the president's right. I noticed they were kind of spread out. And I had wondered to myself, was this to have a, because typically you have the Republicans to the right, Democrats to the left. I wonder if that was to have, make sure that there was sort of cabinet folks across the whole way, which would mean there were people kind of supporting the president's message from, across. So, but that was just a hypothesis. I don't particularly know why they changed it, but that did seem to change.
Right.
It seems also like what you're describing, which is something I thought about too. In general, there seems to be a lessening of a sense of decorum.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. Yeah, and that could go to your earlier point. People do we talked about social media and its impact. Look, there is benefit to people if they can get their moment where they're shouting or acting out of line or out of turn, and that goes immediately up on social media. And I think, then a lot of people use it for, fundraising and stuff. So, what you find is that the people who are more or less closer to the moderate, to the middle, and there are still many, many good people in those range, including, I would say, Senator Romney, who I mentioned a minute ago, there's benefits to folks on the far left or the far right to getting on social media, getting on television, and raising money. I just want to make one point. I mentioned we were talking earlier about infrastructure. And, one way at this is to show where things are actually getting done. And I do think at the state and local level, mayors and governors have to get things done, and they do get things done in a bipartisan way most, quite usually. And at the federal level, while everybody's shouting, you look at some of the achievements that have been in the last year, they have been pretty darn bipartisan. And, one of my favorite moments of the year so far was, I think it was it must have been January, when President Biden went to Kentucky with Mitch McConnell and others. I think Sherrod Brown was there, a Democrat, Mitch McConnell, a Republican, Republican governor of Ohio, Democrat governor of Kentucky, and showed why building these a bridge between Ohio and Kentucky was so important for the people of Ohio and Kentucky. It was problem solving. It's what the American people want to see. And what needs to happen. Some of these bridges are over 100 years old. And so I think one solution to this challenge of the lack of respect and the anger and all that is to actually show the American people where things are happening in their interest, that their lives are going to change, whether that be because they're going to get jobs in the chips industry, whether they're going to be able to drive over a safer bridge, from Kentucky to Ohio. And I think that starts to make an impact. It's maybe not today, tomorrow, but over time, it really does. And the fact that Senator McConnell showed up, and, he has been extremely challenging for Democratic presidents over the years. And he's, stayed, very true to his core, focusing on, I think, the courts mostly. But the fact that he was there and participated, says a lot about of the positive things that we can achieve if we kind of are willing to kind of be in the same room or at the same stage together. And I think the American people really want that.
I sure want that. I think you're 100% right. Steve, we have about 1.5 to 2 minutes left, but I would like to ask you, you have had the opportunity to experience politics from the inside, very deep inside, and that has brought you in touch with both Democrats, of course, you work for Governor Cuomo and President Clinton, and also Republicans. So in the 1 minute remaining, what is it like to be there in the seat of power? Are there differences between Republicans and Democrats? Where is the common line? As you've just mentioned, one of them is showing progress. So tell us just a couple of, give us a glimpse.
Yeah, I think the good ones and between the Democrats and Republicans, I do think it's practical solutions. Mm-hmm. Because when you look and you see that together, Democrats, Republicans, when they work together, they're going to make difference. You look at Moynihan Hall in New York City. It came together under Governor Cuomo, but it took a long time to make happen. Democrats, Republicans. If you look at real successes, it's pretty close to the moderate and the middle. So, I think truly so much noise comes from the far right, and I'll say the far left, people supporting their points of view, and people are entitled to do that. But to me, there's a heck of a lot more in common, mm-hmm. and a lot that people are getting done, and it's a question of being able to focus on it, share ideas, reach agreement, and you use the word, Nina, compromise, which I think is where it's a good place to end.
Yeah, that's
really
actually a very good place to end. Very optimistic note. So we thank you, Steve Silverman, for sharing your views and insights this morning. And our next Ballot Box show is going to be Wednesday, March 15th at 9 a.m. here on WVOX 1460 AM. Hope everyone has a great day.